And you're everybody. I am Matt Cassidy. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. And as Dave said, he is my sponsor. So he's here to keep me honest. And God, I'm so nervous when I do one of these things, and I have to be 100% honest from the get go. Not thrown up in a garbage pail or anything that nervous, but every fear inventory I've ever done, the fear of being unloved, unaccepted, looking like an ass in public, the fear of being found out, always turns up. So for me to get in front of a group of 56, you see, that ego told me there was gonna be 70 people here, so it's not as big of a crowd as I thought it was gonna be, sort of speak in front of this many people in an unfamiliar format, where it's like I'm not going to hear any feedback, no laughs when I say something I think to be funny, I'm just going to look for head nods, when people identify. But the only planning I've done is I just, like Dave said, I'm here to share my story. And out of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, if you have a drinking problem, we hope that you may pause in reading one of our 42 personal stories and think, yes, that happened to me. Or more important, yes, I felt like that. Or most important, yes, I believe this program can work for me too. I've also picked each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. And lastly, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. Those four things kind of tell me exactly what I'm supposed to be doing here. I'm not into a drunkologue because my drinking career was not very long. It's not very entertaining, to be quite honest. But what it does have is it does have all of the aspects of alcoholism, which, I was taught by good sponsorship. When I'm sharing what it was like, I'm given about 45 minutes here. So what I used to be like is one third of my story. So if I'm going past, 15, 18 minutes and I'm still talking about drinking, Dave, anybody, feel free to jump in and start heckling, because, I'm talking too long about the problem and not enough about the solution. And that solution being a G-O-D word, a word that I did not like when I first got here, and I'm sure I'll get to that. I'm also nervous because this is, my second time talking in a year, and I'm sure I'll get to why that is, later on when I get to what my life is like now. But, not to scare you, Mark, but I'm going to talk a little bit about my childhood, but it did not cause my alcoholism. It just has a lot to do with, the other person that I was. I was born into alcoholism. Like I shared, my last name is Cassidy. In case the pale skin and, premature graying hair does not give it away, I am Irish. If there's any doubt of that, I have a Celtic cross tattoo. I have a shamrock tattoo, and I have two leprechaun tattoos just to remind me on a daily basis of how Irish I am. On both sides of the fence, on my mom's side and my dad's side, it's just filled with, alcoholics. If you're not an alcoholic in my family, you marry one just to fit in. And, everybody usually laughs at that, but it is 100% true, because, I talk about two of my uncles. One of my uncles just died about a year and a half ago of cirrhosis of the liver. But when my family talks about, Uncle Butch, they talk about how he died from an infection. Because if we talked about cirrhosis of the liver, then we'd all have to talk about what the real cause of that is, and that would be his alcoholism, that he literally drank himself to death. Another one of my uncles right now is lost his job due to his drinking. His wife threw him out of the house due to his drinking. He's bouncing in and out of sober houses because he can't stay sober, but we don't talk about him at all, because if he's down on they just talk about him being down on his luck when his name does come up, and, hopefully, his luck comes back to him. So it's either the delusion, that runs through my family, not denial, because denial is not wanting to believe, the truth, but knowing it's the truth. My family, we lived in a lot of delusion of, sick alcoholic behavior that was 100% acceptable. At a young age, because I grew up in alcoholism, and I grew up with a father who was physically abusive, mentally, verbally abusive, because I grew up around alcoholism, my mom went into Al-Anon in 1984, You know, so I did have exposure to the 12 steps at a real young age. And I remember, you know, she told us, you know, she sat down and told us that she had joined this organization called Al-Anon, and it was a 12-step fellowship, you know, and it's, you know, she was going to do these 12 steps and she was going to, you know, get well. You know, she explained to us that, you know, she couldn't fix dad's drinking, which, you know, the funny thing about that is when she, you know, she tells the story the way she tells it, which is probably the truth, you know, the that when she sat down to tell us all about my dad's alcoholism, is that, you know, she said, dad has a problem. And my answer to her was, yeah, dad drinks too much, you know, and I knew right away, I guess I could spot alcoholism from a mile away because, you know, even back then, you know, I probably, you know, I was definitely, you know, showing symptoms of it. You know, I just wasn't drinking to fix it. You know, I turned to food at an early age, you know, at my heaviest, I was 5'8", 260 pounds. So, you know, I guess you could say I always had a God-shaped hole. You know, so, you know, I looked for anything and everything to fill that hole, you know, but I never found anything that really fit that hole and took care of the bill until I found, you know, God. And, so, you know, as a result of my, you know, as a result of, you know, growing up in that abusive household, and as a result of, you know, I was sexually abused by a next door neighbor, you know, at a young age. So, you know, I had that to deal with, you know, because of all that stuff that was going on in my life. I remember being, you know, just a young kid. And I was going to Catholic school at the time. So, you know, I remember thinking if there was a God, you know, and this is what he's doing to me, I want nothing to do with him. You know, I definitely missed the mark on, you know, a loving and caring God that they were teaching in school. You know, I would come to, you know, find that God in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the God of my understanding today. You know, but as a young kid, you know, with no belief in a higher power, you know, and, you know, just looking to fill that hole and looking for anything and everything, you know, outside of yourself, you know, I was never satisfied. You know, I always like to tell the story that my mom got a job at a camp for rich people. You know, everybody whose dad was there was like a doctor or a lawyer, you know, and they all made like, you know, five figure salaries back in the 80s, you know, and my mom got a job there. So we got to go for free. And when we started going there, I remember crying that I didn't want to go because I didn't like it. And then when she quit that job and we couldn't go there anymore, I remember crying because now I couldn't go anymore. So, you know, I was never happy regardless of what was going on the outside. You know, I'll fast forward to, you know, 1994, you know, my senior year of high school, you know, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. I do respect the fifth tradition and the third tradition, you know, is that this is, you know, this is about alcohol and alcoholism, but, you know, dry goods are a part of my story, you know, and it was Donnie who spoke a couple of weeks ago who, you know, for the first time in my life, you know, put it in perspective for me. In the book, it talks about how we use, you know, different methods of, you know, to control our drinking. And I believe after hearing him, you know, I was using, you know, truckloads of, you know, dry goods just to treat that, you know, alcoholism, because I had made this promise to myself as a little kid that I would not be an alcoholic, you know, so I had exposure to drinking, you know, but I really didn't want to do it to excess because then, you know, I had this fear that I would become an alcoholic like everybody else in my family. So I used other, you know, substances to, you know, treat my alcoholism, and, you know, they work because they, you know, they take care of the restless irritable discontent that I feel when I have nothing in my body, you know, but, you fast forward to my senior year of high school, you know, and I was at a party and, you know, everybody there was, you know, was drinking, and I knew they were drinking, and, you know, so I was like, all right, I better drink to fit in, you know, because, you know, I had that chameleon side of me before I knew it was going on, you know, before I knew it was a side of me. You know, so I remember drinking that night. So it's like the first time I'm really drinking, I'm getting drunk. And I remember it clear as day because I hadn't hit the blackout yet. But I remember sometime during the party, I was drinking out of a glass because I just knew internally, if you drink out of a bottle, you know, that makes you alcoholic. So I had to drink out of a glass, you know, so I had to look high class, you know, so, I dropped the glass, it shattered on the floor. And I remember still to this day, my first thought was, you know, I was embarrassed because everybody looked at me, and then I was mad because I just wasted alcohol. But then I was relieved when the next thought was there was still plenty more in the fridge, you know? So I know even, you know, from that early point that, you know, I had, you know, the physical allergy, because I know I needed more, you know, once I put it in my body, I would need more. So, you know, that story proves that I have the physical allergy aspect of this disease, you know, which Dr. Silkworth says, you know, makes us alcoholic, you know. My drinking just got worse because this is a progressive illness, you know, so, you know, I had some time to think about this talk before I made it. And the more I thought about it, the more stories that came back to me, and, you know, just like how I could see, like, you know, the progression of my illness, you know, and I, like I said, I talk to my mom often, and, you know, she still goes to Al-Anon. So I shared with her one of the stories, and she's like, "You gonna share that in your talk?" And I was like, "Yeah, I guess so, because, you know, it produced, you know, an effect on you." So, you know, I told her a story of how, you know, somebody down the hall from me in college brought a bottle down. I was like, "Hey, you want to try this?" You know, so I, by that time, had already developed, you know, the mental obsession. So my mind goes, "Yeah, we never had that. We got to try it," even though I know I had worked before. You know, but I still thought at that time that I can control my drinking, so I'll just have one or two, and then I'll, you know, have enough time before I go to work. But of course, one led to two, led to three, led to, you know, more and more. And then I was like, "Oh crap, I got to go to work." So I call my boss and I tell him that, I was like, "Oh yeah, you know, I can't come into work today." He's like, "Oh no, what's the matter?" You know, he was actually showing true concern. You know, and I said, "Oh, I hurt my shoulder." You know, I couldn't just, you know, it couldn't just come with an easy excuse, like, "I don't feel good." You know, it's like, you know, I had to come with something like, you know, big, you know, so to make him really feel sorry for me. He's like, "Oh, I hurt my shoulder." He's like, "Oh, okay." He's like, you know, he's like, "Well," he's like, "well, you know, I hope it gets better. We'll see you around." I was like, "Oh, okay, yeah, thanks." So the next day when I woke up, I worked in the building where the school cafeteria was. So now I realized that I would have to walk past my boss on my way to go to breakfast at the cafeteria. And I just told him I hurt my shoulder. So to cover the lie with yet another lie, I actually took my shoulder and I bashed it up against the bedpost of my bed until it was black and blue, so that I could stop at the infirmary on my way to the cafeteria, so that they would give me a sling or give me an ice pack or give me something, you know. And I was just like, you know, and that story came back to me. I was like, "Oh my God!" I was like, the lies that I, you know, the lengths that I went to have to cover up my lies, you know. You know, another time that I thought of is, you know, I went to get out of bed one morning after a heavy night of drinking, and I went to stand up and I keeled over like a Jenga board, you know, and I fell flat on my face. And when I looked down at my ankle, I was like, "Oh yeah, that's right. I did something to my ankle, which would explain why it's the size of a grapefruit and purple like a grape." I was like, "Now it all makes sense why I can't stand up." You know, so, you know, there was another time that, you know, I mean, there's a questionnaire on our SIA meeting list up here, you know, for Suffolk County. This is, you know, "Did you ever wind up in a hospital due to your drinking?" You know, so I always thought when I first saw that list that it meant, you know, did I wind up in detox and rehab? And I could say, "Oh no." But the more I thought honestly about my drinking, I was like, "Yeah, I did wind up in the hospital numerous times because of my drinking." You know, so I could easily change my answer to yes on that one. You know, so my drinking just got worse. You know, it was like, there were times like, you know, I went to a family party, you know, it was my grandparents' 50th wedding anniversary. And, you know, they had an open bar, you know, because like I said, we're surrounded by alcoholics. So, you know, what would a party be without, you know, without an open bar? And I remember walking up to it and, you know, somebody was nice enough to list all of the beers. And most people would look at that as, "I have choice. You know, I could have this one or I could have that one, or, you know, or I could have the liquor on the top shelf, you know." So most people look at it as choice. I looked at the list up on the wall as a mission statement. You know, I had to go from top to bottom and back up to the top if I had enough time, you know. So, and that's what I did for the night. I went down the list. I went back up. In between, I threw in some hard liquor because they did, you know, again, they had to have the top shelf stuff, you know, none of that cheap stuff, you know, for a Cassidy family affair. But, you know, I'll just fast forward to my last drunk. You know, my last drunk was nothing, you know, exciting, nothing spectacular, to be quite honest. But what did happen to me that night was I needed the last piece of the puzzle that I could see clearly, you know, so that I could know how much trouble I was in. You know, that night I was going to a party, you know, and it was about an hour and a half drive from my house, you know, so I sat in my driveway, you know, getting ready to leave for the party. And I remember making a solemn oath to myself, like Bill talks about in the book, we make solemn oaths with or without a Bible. Okay. I didn't have a Bible handy, but if I did, I probably would have sworn on it that tonight I was not going to take a drink. Okay. It's not that I didn't want to drink, but by this time, everybody was calling me alcoholic, you know, except me. So I was not going to drink that night to prove to everybody that I wasn't alcoholic. So if you've ever had to prove to somebody that you're not alcoholic, you're probably alcoholic, you know, in case there's anybody out there who has any doubt, you know. So I leave for the party and I'm not going to drink. Okay. It takes about 45 minutes to get from my house to the next county line. By the time I got to the next county line, I remember clearly the thought that crossed my mind. Okay. The thought that crossed my mind, not that I had to make up any, you know, not that I had to like think about it. It just popped into my head. It was, it's going to be a 6-hour party. If we go to a 6-hour party and we buy a 6-pack and we drink one beer an hour, that's social drinking. That's not alcohol. So you can still drink and you can still prove to everybody that you're not alcoholic because you can show them that you can control your drinking. And that I know today is the mental obsession, you know, that missing piece of being the true alcoholic on page 21. You know, I went to the party that night and I went and I bought a 6-pack and, you know, just I tore off all the labels, you know, and I made this grandiose announcement to everybody because, you know, when I speak, everybody listens, so that there's a 6-pack in the fridge. Nobody drink it. Those are mine, you know, and it was like about 20, 25 minutes later, somebody goes walking past with a beer without a label on it. And I was like, that's my beer. They don't listen to me. Who the hell are these people? Well, screw them. Then I'm going to, if they're drinking my beer, then I'm going to drink all theirs, you know, so then, you know, off to the races I went. You know, so when I woke up the next morning, you know, I was like, where was my thought of not drinking when the time came? Where was all of my willpower? I knew it was non-existent. You know, it was the first moment of clarity out of many that I would have, you know, in sobriety, you know, and that was the morning of May the 5th of 1996. And I'm, you know, proud to say due to God's grace and good sponsorship and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's still my sobriety date. You know, so I'm an Irish guy, you know, I don't know about up in Canada, but down here in the United States, you know, on St. Patrick's Day, everybody pretends to be Irish, you know, so they can drink. And on Cinco de Mayo, May the 5th, everybody pretends to be Mexican so they can drink. You know, so I'm the Irish guy who got sober on a Mexican holiday. So if I ever come across in sobriety, the Mexican guy who got sober on St. Patrick's Day, I'm telling you right now, him and I are going to start a big book study. Okay. Scout's honor. Okay. So I see my buddy Charlie laughing because St. Patrick's Day is his sobriety date. But he's Irish, you know, so it doesn't count, you know, but so there I was, you know, stone cold sober now, not, you know, and not wanting to take another drink. But it took me 2 weeks to be convinced that I still couldn't do it myself. You know, I remember driving around one night, you know, and I was just like, I'm going to drive around to every 7-Eleven and just drink coffee. And I drove around to every 7-Eleven, you know, out by my house. And I probably drank, you know. I'm still, you know, I still got an alcoholic mind. It's just not alcohol because I was only 19 at the time. So I couldn't go into 7-Eleven and buy beer. So I couldn't buy a small coffee. I had to buy the large coffee, you know. So I drove to like 8 7-Elevens drinking like 8 20-ounce cups of coffee, wondering why my hands were shaking and why I couldn't sleep that night, you know. You know, I think that's like equal to an urn. I'm not exactly sure. But, you know, so I wind up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, at some meetings, because at that time I was also in the rooms of Al-Anon, you know, because like I told you, my mom was in Al-Anon. So I thought my dad's drinking was my problem. So if I went to Al-Anon, I could work on myself, like my mom worked on myself, worked on herself, and things would be okay. You know, but the problem was, you know, in between when I got sober and, you know, before I got sober, I went to an Al-Anon conference and I found myself nodding in agreement with the AA speaker. So I was like, you know, so even then, like, that was another moment of clarity before I stopped drinking. I was like, why am I relating to an alcoholic? You know, it was like, you know, red flags along the way, but I never saw them, you know? So I'm sitting in the rooms of AA. I go to my very first meeting, you know, closed meeting. And I'm like, I'm mad and I think I'm an alcoholic, and, you know, they let me ramble on for a little bit, you know? And then when I was all done, the speaker just goes, Matt, if you think you're an alcoholic, you probably are one. Because normal people don't sit around and wonder if they're alcoholic, you know? So I was kind of let down by that, because I was kind of hoping he'd let me off the hook. And like, you know, like after I had talked, like, no, you're not alcoholic. But, you know, he, you know, he kind of like, you know, put the final, you know, final nail in my coffin. You know, God started doing for me what I could not do for myself, because my first sponsor, you know, I, you know, walked in the room that night after I shared, and I knew he was going to be my sponsor. So, you know, it's a little miracle started to happen along the way. You know, unfortunately, part of my story was the first 4 months of my sobriety, I was hanging out with a crowd that was just simply don't drink, go to meetings, you know, hang out at the diner, go to, you know, join the softball team. You know, I remember sharing one night that, you know, I wanted to do my fourth and fifth step, and somebody telling me, you're not sober enough to do a fourth and fifth step. You don't have enough time, you know? So those were the type of people that, you know, that I was surrounded with. So, you know, I was about 100 days sober. I moved from New York down to North Carolina, Greensboro, North Carolina, to go back to college. You know, so I knew that I needed to plug into the fellowship down there. So I started going to meetings in Greensboro, North Carolina. And I was about 100 days sober, you know, sitting in the rooms of AA, dying of untreated alcoholism and not knowing what my problem was, you know. But down there, if you've never been down to North Carolina, my experience is, you know, especially the Greensboro Triad area, they're big book country. You know, they talk straight out the book. They quote the book. That everybody carries a book, you know. So it's like, so all of a sudden I see these people walking around carrying big books, walking in a room, sharing out the big book, you know, carrying a big book message. And I was like, what are these people talking about? I mean, it's like I read the first 164 pages because somebody told me to read it, and I read it like a book, and there was no surprise ending. There was no, you know, there was no, you know, there was no plot twist going on. You know, it was like some guy named Bill and some guy named Bob, and, you know, but other than that, I was just like, you know, it's, you know, some guy named Fred, and, you know, and I just didn't get it because nobody ever explained to me that it was a basic text. It was a textbook, you know, something that was meant to be studied. It was something that meant to be applied. You know, the, you know, my second sponsor that I met down in, you know, North Carolina, you know, by name, man by the name of Joe Jay, I certainly hope he was able to make the meeting tonight, because I gave him the link. But, you know, when I met him, you know, he actually sat down with me and showed me the, you know, the cover, you know, he showed me the big book, you know, and then he opened it up to the cover page, and he, you know, he goes, look, he goes, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many of thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. He was the first person to show me that I could recover from this disease, that I was not always going to be sick from it, you know, that, you know, that I could get well. You know, he explained to me that that was the book that him and I would be reading together. You know, he said we'd be getting together once a week to do some reading and do some step work. You know, I don't know what night of the week I met him, but, you know, the first weekend that I was with him, he goes, oh, and we'll go to a rehab. He goes, so you can meet some other people. And we show up to the rehab and they're like, Joe, are you speaking today? He goes, no, you need a speaker? He goes, yeah. He goes, this is Matt. He just moved here from New York. He's your speaker for today. You know, so he kind of like threw me right into service work too, you know, working with others, you know. So, you know, I just remember sitting down with him and, you know, going through the book, and, you know, he did to me what he was supposed to do. He qualified me as an alcoholic. You know, he made sure that I had mental obsession. He made sure that I had physical craving. You know, he made sure that I knew exactly how screwed I was. You know, he made sure that I understood that AA was the last house on the block for me, that if there was any way that I could stop drinking on my own, I probably had already tried it and it did not work. You know, he reminded me of such mean things like, you know, I came to AA. AA did not come to me. It's not like they knocked on my door and begged me for membership, you know? So, you know, just the way that he lovingly crushed my ego, because that's what I needed in order to get well. I needed to be told in a loving, caring way that, you know, that I had a problem and that AA was the only answer that he had to offer. You know, he said he was going to give me the 12 steps of recovery, you know, which is the only thing he had to offer, because it was the only thing he had, you know. And the, you know, I remember when he first gave me that talk, I remember saying to him that the, you know, I know it works for you. I know it works for your sponsor. I said, but I really don't know if it's going to work for me. You know, and he pointed out to me, he goes, Matt, he goes, you haven't worked the 12 steps yet. He goes, why don't you work them and see if they don't work for you? He says, before you have an opinion on it. You know, so I agreed to do that. You know, I agreed to work the 12 steps. You know, at that time, you know, the, you know, again, he also shoved me into service work, you know, the, you know, there was a young people's conference that people were trying to build down there at the time. There was a really young, really hardcore young people's movement at the time. You know, there's a bunch of us young people, you know, who, you know, newly in sobriety, you know, we only had like a couple of years max, but, you know, we all had a common purpose. We wanted to put on this convention. You know, so we got into service work, you know, we got into going to different meetings and carrying a message. We got into, you know, grabbing other people's like, hey, you just shared a meeting and you got nothing to do, or you're bored in sobriety. Why don't you come help us? You know? And so around me, the fellowship that I craved started to grow up around me. You know, all I had to do was show up and be a part of it. You know, so, you know, I was involved with that. I was going through the step work with Joe, and, you know, I remember the first fifth step. He says to me, he goes, well, it's your first fifth step. So, he goes, you get to pick the location where we're going to do it. He goes, I just want to make sure that you're comfortable. And the only answer I could come up with, I said, well, why don't we do it in my apartment? And he's like, okay, if that's where you feel comfortable. I was like, yeah. I was like, that's where I feel comfortable. Cause in the back of my head was, when I'm done with this, he can't throw me out because it's my apartment. And that's the only reason why I wanted to do it there, you know, because I had this big fear of when I opened myself up to another human being for the first time in my life, you know, I had this fear of rejection. But when we went through that fifth step, all I found was a loving, caring person who understood where I came from and was there just to help me, you know, see my defects of character, you know, to see the things within me that blocked me off from, you know, from God. You know, when that school year ended, you know, I had gotten a call from my parents because my dad was like, I'm starting to think about retirement. And what do you think my biggest expenditure was? And I was like, out of state tuition. And he's like, yeah, it is. So he said, you know, he goes, so you're going to come home. He said, we'll send you to a local college. He said, but, you know, you're not going to go to school out of state anymore. You know, so I was like, okay. I was like, so I get to go to college, but just not this college. He's like, yeah. I said, okay. I really can't argue with that. You know, so, so I had to move back from North Carolina, and I came back to New York, and I was trying to carry that big book message. You know, it's, you know, it's like, hey guys, here's what's in the book. Here's what it says. Look, we can be recovered and stuff. And I was met with a lot of resistance, you know, from a lot of people, you know, and, you know, unfortunately over time, it, you know, rather than, you know, care more about, you know, God's will for me, which is to, you know, help others, I started to care more about, you know, fitting in and more, you know, so, you know, by the, you know, by the time I was done with college, you know, I met my, you know, soon to be wife, you know, so, you know, we'd started dating. So, you know, I had a fiance, then, you know, that we were going to get, we got married, then I got a house and, you know, I had, you know, I changed jobs into a better job. So I had all this stuff going for me in life. You know, so I was kind of shifting away from, you know, giving everything to God, and I wanted to take credit for it, and I wanted to enjoy the life that I was being given, you know, and I slowly turned into a, you know, don't drink and go to meetings guy. You know, I was working with people, but I wasn't exactly taking them through the, you know, taking them through the book. You know, I was kind of like, you know, cutting corners, you know, the, and, you know, the, I'm not, you know, I'm not proud of that period of my sobriety because, you know, it was, you know, the, if I ever heard it, I forgot it, but, you know, Dave told me the other day, you know, it's sobriety, not sobriety, you know, that I was, you know, he uses the expression, I was so dry, I was a fire hazard. And, you know, I could definitely agree with that, you know, so, you know, needless to say, you know, over time, you know, the, it says in the book that I'm in the grips of a progressive illness. It says nothing about it's only progressive when I'm drinking. You know, I know today my alcoholism gets worse even when I'm not drinking, you know, so the spiritual malady was, you know, starting to come back, you know, the, you know, and it's like, I know today the spiritual malady, if left untreated, makes fertile ground for the mental obsession, a mental obsession that I have no treatment for. You know, I can't use the broken mind, you know, to be defensive against that first drink. You know, it has to come from a higher power. You know, so I'm probably in a lot more danger than I knew of, you know, and it was around this time, you know, that, you know, I knew the answer was in the book. So I was just like, you know what? I was like, whether I'm, you know, going to be liked or I'm not going to be liked is none of my business. You know, it's what God wants me to do, you know, and, you know, helping others. So I went and I bought a brand new big book because at the time I was walking around, you know, still my third edition big book, you know, because I got sober in 96 and the fourth edition wasn't published till 2001. So I used to walk around my third edition to show just how sober I was, you know, it was, you know, I would use it like a badge of honor, you know, so, but me, you know, so I went and I bought a brand new fourth edition big book. And I know that in the book, I'm like, all right, I know there's beliefs I'm supposed to have. I know that there's steps I'm supposed to take. You know, I know that there's action that's supposed to be done. And most importantly, I know that there's promises in this book. I don't know about up in Canada or any other parts of the United States where some of you folks are, but in meetings down here, they'll close meetings with reading the promises. And they read the ninth step promises. And it, they go the hair on the back of my neck while I'm saying it. You know, it just drives me nuts. I'm like, you folks have no idea if you think that those 12 promises are the only ones in the book. You know, there's third step promises. There are 10 step promises. There are promises where they don't need to be more promises. You know, so I came with this crazy highlighter scheme, you know, just, you know, because I wanted to do it, you know, perfect, of course, you know, because an alcoholic can't ever, you know, settle for moderation, you know, so I highlighted this new book, and where it said I was action to take, I took action, and where it said there's a prayer, I got down on my knees and I said those prayers. And it was around this time where I went to a big book, you know, convention, and the, you know, Chris R was the speaker, you know, so I went up to him after the meeting because I knew he had, you know, he was friends with Dave. So I was like, I went up to him after a meeting. I was like, can you give me Dave Fredrickson's phone number? I says, I'd like to reach out to him and talk with him, you know, so, cause Dave got sober at 19, I got sober at 19, you know, so, you know, I knew there was stuff that we'd have in common. So, you know, Chris goes, all right, I don't give away a phone number without taking one in return. He says, so he goes, I'll give you Dave's phone number, but you got to give me yours. So I said, okay, sure, no problem. I'm like I'll ever hear from Chris Raymer. You know, it's like my phone will ever ring with him on the other end. But hey, he asked for it, so I gave it to him. You know, so I reached out to Dave, and you know, like you said, you know, that was 2010. I literally stalked him, you know, the, at the time, you know, he was working out of, you know, he'd be working out of New York, you know, so, I'd go visit him before, you know, before he had to go to work, and, I'd meet him at the airport, you know, and, you know, we'd have like 45 minute chat or something. So, you know, like, so it probably qualifies as stalking, but it was definitely, you know, good times. And the, fast forward a couple of years, you know, my first kid was born. I'm like, you know what? I'm like, my life is changing. So I decided to change sponsors. I asked Dave to sponsor me. And, you know, if you ever ask Dave to work with you, Dave has a plethora of spiritual exercises to give you. You know, a yes from Dave never comes lightly, you know. So off I came on like a new spiritual journey with, you know, these things to do. And, you know, so I started doing these exercises, you know, and, you know, and like, you know, no big surprise, you start doing spiritual exercise, you start getting spiritually fit, you start getting spiritually fit, and you start carrying a message of depth and weight. You know, so I was going to meetings and I was sharing, you know, I'd open a Matt Cassidy and people were like, why does he got to share his last name? And I'm a recovered alcoholic. Why does he say he's recovered? You know, I was like, you know, there was one cranky old timer who had almost 40 years of sobriety, who used to introduce himself, I'm so-and-so, I'm a recovering alcoholic. And he like yell it while locking eyes with me. And I was like, doesn't this dude know that I've resigned from debating society? I was like, I really don't care how, you know, what he thinks, you know? So, but, you know, again, I got more pushback, but at that time in my life, I cared more about saving lives than I cared about being liked. You know, and again, what happened was those people who liked what I shared and those people who identified with me, those were the people I started hanging out with. Though, you know, again, so the fellowship I craved started to bounce up around me, you know. So, you know, my son was born in 2011, you know, and that was the first sign that got, you know, that a God of my understanding truly trusted me, because when I got sober, I couldn't even take care of myself, you know. So, you know, you fast forward, I was 14 years sober, you know, and I'm like, so 14 years sober, God gave me another human being to take care of, you know. I know today God trusts me with one of his kids to take care of, you know. He's not my kid, he's God's kid. I'm just here to, you know, steer him on the right path. And the, you know, my daughter was born in 2015, you know, and she's just a, she's a handful and a half, you know. So, you know, she's four now. And the, you know, so, the, you know, she's another blessing, you know, in my life. But, you know, the, I didn't know how much truth was going to come out of me, but apparently God wants me to talk about it. you know, after my daughter was born, you know, the, you know, about a couple weeks after my daughter was born, all of a sudden, like, I was just like, I was like forever tired, you know, and I would, you know, and I, all of a sudden I wanted like nothing to do with my daughter. I wanted nothing to do with my wife. I wanted nothing to, you know, I wanted nothing to do with, you know, I was not picking up phone calls. I didn't want to talk to anybody. You know, I would go to my home group to chair a meeting and people would just take one look at me and they're like, are you okay? You know, you should probably go see a doctor, you know, because I looked horrendous. I was, you know, in 10 days, I lost 10 pounds. There was something going on. And, you know, I go to the emergency room one night, you know, and I'm just like, and I give them all my symptoms and everything. And they took blood tests and, you know, and everything came back negative. And the doctor goes, I have no idea what's going on with you. He's like, you know, just, they discharged me from the emergency room with just a, you know, goodbye and good luck, you know. And the, when I got home the next day, I get a phone call from a family friend who's a nurse practitioner, because apparently my wife, you know, behind my back called my mom, you know, and told her what was going on. You know, my mom in turn behind my back calls this family friend who's a nurse practitioner. And so she calls me, she's like, Matt, I'd just like to talk to you for a little bit, because, you know, everybody's concerned about, you know, what's going on with you. You know, so I'm like, okay. So, you know, I'm talking to her, I'm telling what's going on. And I'm like, you know, and I tell her I went to the emergency room and they, you know, they gave me a blood test. And so they put me on it. The only thing that they had to offer me was they put me on an antibiotic for like any exotic, like bug bites, you know? So if I happened to come down with like the first case of malaria since 1917, I would have been okay, you know, but they had no idea, you know, what was going on with me. And so when the conversation was ended, she goes, Matt, she goes, I've listened to everything you said. She goes, in case you don't know, she goes, you're not even breathing. She goes, you take a light breath. She goes, and then you're sighing out after every breath. You know, she goes, Matt, she goes, you're showing signs of depression. You know, and she's like, whether you know it or not, you know, and like, in my mind, you know, I'm like, I'm a step guy, you know, I do the steps, and, you know, I should be fine. And, you know, that there should be nothing going on. And at first I was closed-minded, and she's like, you know, and then she like, she threw in like a little sales pitch. She's like, I'm not here to treat you. I'm just here to guide you. You know, I'm here to help you in whichever way you want, you know? So I was like, you know what? I was like, everything I've tried doesn't work, and I've gone to everybody, you know, I've gone to doctors and they have no idea. So, you know, I guess I'll just give it a shot. And, you know, so I was kind of open-minded, you know, to being treated for something different, you know, for something different. And again, it was another disease that I didn't want, you know, but obviously I was showing symptoms of it. So maybe I would need to be treated for it, you know, so she did put me on a medication. And, you know, I know today that, you know, that is another problem. It is a problem outside of alcoholism. And I guess the only reason why I'm sharing, you know, guys got me sharing it from a podium is because if there's anybody else going through anything that, you know, there are problems other than alcoholism. It does say in the book, in the, you know, in the 130s that, you know, God does give us, you know, good doctors, you know, to treat us or something like that. I'm not going to, I am paraphrasing because I'm not a big book, you know, memorizer guy, you know, but, you know, so there are doctors out there to help you if you do have other problems. Don't think, you know, just because you're taking the 12 steps that if you've got problems other than, you know, I like to use the analogy, you know, so if I was a diabetic, do I take the 12 steps to take care of my insulin, you know, problem? Or can I just, you know, take some insulin and treat, you know, treat that out, you know, outside issue because, you know, with outside, you know, fixing. So, God, like I said, I guess I, God wanted me to be a lot more honest than I planned on being, you know, but, you know, so what it's like now, you know, what my life is like now is the, you know, I do treat that outside stuff with, you know, with outside help, you know, I actually did have a, you know, therapy session before this today. And, you know, due to this whole COVID thing, you know, I'm doing a Zoom meeting now with, you know, oh, it's only 57 people. We're still not at 70. My ego's really let down. You know, but, you know, the, I had to do a Zoom, you know, teletherapy meeting today. So like my entire life, you know, today is like almost Zoom. And, you know, just, I'm actually loving this format, you know, cause the, you know, I used to love going to my home group, you know, in person, you know, by the way, my home group is the Longwood Love and Service Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet in Ridge, New York on Tuesdays and Thursday nights at 8 o'clock. So if anybody's ever in the area and you'd like to, you know, fellowship, you know, I did put, I didn't write down any notes, but I just lied again before. So I'll make amends to that. I wrote a note that says give email address. So my email address was in the chat room. So, so if any of you guys see the MFC50596@AOL.com, that's my email address. Feel free to shoot me a letter because with, you know, the one thing that has come out of this whole Zoom thing is I now have friends and, you know, obviously, you know, Alberta, Canada, hey, Mark, you know, giving him a shout out, you know, the, you know, I made friends with, you know, Cody who spoke a couple weeks ago out of Seattle, Washington, you know, I see my buddy Charlie, you know, Charlie, you know, from Greensboro, North Carolina on here. So I'm like connecting with people, you know, in all parts of the United States when I, you know, when I actually spoke to Mark on the phone for the first time and, you know, it's, you know, we, again, like it says in the book, we're people that do not mix, you know, the, you know, I'm talking to a Canadian on the phone who lives in the, you know, he's the first person I ever talked to in Mount, you know, who's, who lives in Mountain Time. But with that solidified, I now have a friend in every time zone. And, you know, to me, that was like, I was like, that's the coolest, those, you know, so, so thanks Mark for your friendship. So we can take care of that last time zone. And, you know, so, you know, it, this whole Zoom thing has been a trip, you know, I did say I would, you know, the reason why I haven't talked much is, you rewind about like about 8-9 months ago. And I slowly started to pull away from, you know, my home group. I slowly started to pull away from the fellowship. I had a resentment against my home group, you know, something was going down that I didn't like. And, you know, rather than bring it to a business meeting and voicing my concern and, you know, who knows, maybe become group, you know, group conscience, or whatever, you know, I got a resentment. And the first thing I stopped doing is I stopped sharing at meetings. You know, and then I realized it was like, wait a minute, I'm not doing too much step work lately, you know, so I really can't share anything because I don't have current experience, you know, so I kind of justified not sharing also. And I was, so I stopped sharing at the meeting. And then I started putting other stuff in life ahead of, you know, the fellowship. And, you know, so I started dwindling down. And, you know, as Dave and I have had many discussions, you know, my magic number of meetings, plural, so it's supposed to be minimum 2, hence the English language of adding an S on the end, you know, it has to be a plural. You know, my minimum number of meetings slipped below 2, so I was only making 1 meeting a week. So, you know, I wasn't even doing that. And then, you know, one easily turns into zero. So, you know, so I'm not partaking in the fellowship, you know, so I'm not staying in the middle of the herd, you know, the, you know, I'm not talking to my sponsor. I'm not, you know, I'm not sponsoring my last sponsee, you know, disappeared into the, you know, into the clouds of, you know, Never Never Land. So I'm not really doing anything, you know, and again, ego starts to come back that, you know, Dave calls it spiritual plaque, you know, it's like the spiritual plaque started to come back. And it's like, all of a sudden, you know, I'm living a life that I think is great because I'm quote, I'm not drinking. So therefore I got to be doing good. And it's, you know, I'm slowly slipping back through the steps. I'm way back into the third step where if the world would do what I want, everything would be okay. You know, and I probably came the closest I ever came to a drink in my life, you know, back in January. You know, I was actually, you know, I went away to a, you know, karate convention / competition, and everybody else that I was hanging out with, they wanted to hang out in the bar. And, you know, I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, I can go to a bar. I've gone to a bar a million times. Well, our book says that you can go to a bar, number one, if you have a legitimate reason for being there. And number two, if you're on a firm spiritual foundation. Well, I had a legitimate reason to be there because everybody else was going there and I got to fit in. But my, you know, but I was certainly not on a firm spiritual foundation. And I was sitting in a bar, you know, and I'm just like, I was probably the most miserable person in there. And what proof do I need of that? Okay. Is that the fact that a woman who was talking to the group actually came up to me and goes, you know, that guy looks like he's having fun. And he pointed, you know, he pointed at my friend Ron. He's just, but you look miserable, you know? And of course, what does a good alcoholic do? You know, we're sensitive people, you know, it says in the 12 and 12, that it takes us a while to grow out of that sensitivity. So I took it personal, even though she's telling the truth, and, you know, and I turned into a resentment, you know, so I left the bar because I didn't want to be in the same room with this woman anymore. So I think God actually saved my life through a resentment, you know, because I walked out of there because, like I said, that's probably the closest I would ever be to a drink again. I hope ever again, you know, because the only thing that was keeping me sober at that moment was ego. You know, because I was, you know, I'll be 24 years sober in May, and, you know, here it is in January, and I'm already projecting 4 months into the future, you know, so, ego can only last that long, you know, that strange mental blank spot probably would have took over sooner or later. And a thought would have crossed my mind because I have no defense. I probably would have, you know, probably would have drank, you know, so, again, you know, Dave, one of the spiritual exercises Dave gave me was, you know, he had me write down a miracles list. And of course that made the list, you know, that I stayed sober during this, you know, during this past dry spell, you know, it's only, you know, I joke now, it took a global pandemic to get me back to my home group. You know, it was, you know, the funny thing about it was I lost the power of choice to not go to meetings anymore. You know, I couldn't go to a meeting anymore. So, you know, so I knew that they had this Zoom format, and I found out from somebody who had the link, you know, it was like, how do I get to our meetings? So they sent me the link. So I showed up, and the first thing that, you know, the first thing that happened was, number one, a lot of the people, they don't care why I was gone. They were just like, hey, we're glad to have you back. You know, and the, you know, a couple of years ago, I was on my home group's steering committee on making our group conscious because we were kind of off the rails a little bit, and they wanted to, you know, get us back on track. So they're like, hey, let's have a steering committee, you know, and let's actually put, you know, pen to paper and, you know, come up with our group conscience so that we know what it is instead of it being word of mouth. So I was, you know, so being one of the old timers in the group who had actually been around the group for a long time, you know, I wasn't a founding member of the group, but I was part of the first, you know, the first wave of, you know, membership, you know, run pledging committee. You know, so we put together group conscience, and, you know, and that group conscience, a lot of it still stands today. So with this whole new Zoom format, they were like, hey, you know, we need a little bit of a change here. And I was like, I jumped right up to the plate. I said, well, I happen on my computer. I still have the, you know, all the openings to all the meetings, because when we left our church, you know, meeting place, all the books were there. So everybody was just kind of like going by memory of like how to open up a meeting. And, you know, I was like, I still got it on my computer. I'll be more than happy to update it, you know, for the current, for any current, you know, changes we have. I'll get rid of the stuff that doesn't apply, and I'll add stuff that does apply, you know. So I changed, you know, I changed all the openings, you know, for the new Zoom format. So I immediately jumped back into service for my home group. You know, this, the Zoom format, like I said, allows me to meet new people in new different places. I mean, I go to a meeting, there's one Friday night. I'm like, oh, let me go to a meeting tomorrow. Oh, there's a Saturday morning as Bill sees it meeting. And I'm like, I'm not a, you know, I like Bill's writing. I like Bill as a person, you know, so I'm like, all right, maybe it'll, you know, I'll go sit on that, you know, who knows how it's going to be. So I went and I, you know, joined in on that meeting, and, you know, there was a whole bunch of people bitching about, you know, oh, this COVID thing and it's isolation and, you know, I'm stuck in the house with my kids and, you know, somebody take my kid, you know, somebody come and take my kids. And by this point, like I said, I'm already working with Dave again, and Dave's giving me spiritual exercise. I'm plugged back into service work. I'm plugged back into my home group. And I'm like, you know what? I guess it's time to either not be light, because it's time to be a service. So when it came my turn to share, you know, I was like, yeah, I'm in a house with my wife who's working from home, and I'm in a house with a 4-year-old, you know, who's not getting her special needs, you know, stuff. I said, I'm in a house with an 8-year-old. I says, whose hobby is to not listen and make me repeat myself about 1,000 times a day. I said, but I said, my sponsor, I says, has me working spiritual exercises. I says, he has me working with, you know, 12 daily prayers and 12 daily meditations. I was like, the first of which, I says, comes right out of the big book. It's in the 9th step. It says that we ask God to show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindness, of love for each member of the family, you know, and he had me sit with that. And what does it look like towards each member of the family? So it showed me that I could be of service to my family. It's like, so if I'm the first one up in the morning, it's easy to either pour my son a bowl of cereal or to make him a cheese omelet. You know, it's easy to make my wife, you know, breakfast. I can make, you know, I can make my daughter breakfast, you know, and the, you know, but the whole thing about that was when I first started doing it, I was like, I'm doing service, but I'm not getting what I want in return. You know, I found out there's still a lot of ego in the picture. You know, I was like, I wanted, when I come down the stairs, I wanted to be greeted by that, you know, Canyon of Heroes ticker tape parade welcome. It's like, oh, he's here to do service to us. He's so great. You know, instead I remembered, oh, that's right. Service is a thankless position. You know, the, my, like I said, my introduction to service, you know, was, you know, being thrown in front of a rehab by that guy, Joe. He also taught me that service, you know, my introduction to service with him, you know, was, you know, one day, you know, he asked me point blank when I was going to be a giver. You know, he pointed out to me that I was a taker my whole life. When are you going to be a giver? You know, and I was like, I don't understand what you mean. You know, what do you mean by that? You know, and he goes, I want to know when are you going to do something for somebody and look for nothing in return? You know, and that was a concept to me that I needed to more explanation. And because I said to myself, well, I did do service. You know, I said, and now I'm going to date myself. You know, I said, I dumped my ashtray after the meeting. I says, I threw out my coffee cup after the meeting. I said, I cleaned up. You know, so he brought to my attention that dumping an ashtray that I smoked out of, dumping a coffee cup that I drank out of, and pushing in a chair that my ass occupied for the meeting was not service work. That just means that my mother raised me right. He said, go dump somebody else's ashtray, push somebody else's chair in. He says, and throw out somebody else's coffee cup. He goes, go do for somebody else and look for nothing in return. Don't look for an attaboy. Don't look for accolades. He goes, just do it, because it's doing for some, it's giving without a price tag. You know, like I said, you know, Dr. Bob said in his final talk that the, you know, the 12 steps boil down to, you know, two things, love and service. And that's why I belong to a group called Love and Service. You know, that's what the whole deal is about. You know, I'm going to come to love God's children, and I'm going to want to be of service to them. You know, that 12th step, you know, is explained to me, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. So I'm guaranteed to get the only thing that's going to solve my problem. That's how We Agnostics chapter starts off with. If you're alcoholic, you know, you may be suffering from a malady, which only a spiritual experience will conquer. So it doesn't leave much room for what I need to get well, you know, but that's, you know, Joe pointed out to me that it was guaranteed to me as a result of the 12 steps. I have to do the 12 steps. If I don't do the 12 steps, then I'm not going to get well. It's not how many meetings I make, you know, Derek, I'm going to quote Cliff, man, because I love it. You know, like Cliff Bishop used to say, you know, it's not the meetings that we make, it's the steps we take, you know, that get us sober, you know. And, you know, I never met the man, but, you know, God, you know, did I fall in love with a whole lot of stuff that he had to say, you know. And, you know, the other thing I got, you know, like I said, Chris Raymer took my number at that conference, and just to, you know, just to give, you know, give a shout out to the, you know, to the guy who got me in this trouble to begin with, you know, my buddy Derek, who, you know, spoke last week, and, you know, who's on here tonight, you know, I kind of, you know, alluded to it last week, but, you know, I'm at work one night and I get a phone call out of the blue, you know, and I don't answer it because it's a strange area code. But when I get a voicemail from it, it's some guy from Kansas who's visiting New York and wants to get, you know, who got my number from Chris. And I was like, holy crap. I was like, so when you give your number away, don't be surprised if somebody ever uses it. You know, so I had to give this guy a call back because I've given my number away 1,000 times face to face. And, never, you know, if I'm lucky, I get a phone call 10 times out of 1,000. You know, and I, you know, I gave my number to this guy who gave it to this guy, and he called me, and we've been buds ever since. You know, he flew up here on his own dime last summer. You know, when I got to renew my my wedding vows with my wife for our 15th anniversary. You know, and it's cool when you can, you know, it says in the book that, you know, we're going to commence shoulder to shoulder with people and we're going to form lifelong bonds. And it's like, that's, you know, when I think of him, I know that that's true. When I think of guys like Charlie, I know that's true because we, you know, we've been friends for, you know, over 2 decades now. You know, we may not see each other all the time. We may not talk all the time, but, you know, you can truly form friendships, and I love this Zoom format again, because, you know, out of that meeting that I went to that Saturday morning and I shared I just shared, you know, some spirituality and I dumped some God into the mix, you know, I share another thing that Dave has me do. He has me call 6 alcoholics a day. And it's like, you work with David, but the bar can't be set low. It's got to be a pole vault level, you know? So it's like, I'll not want to call 6 people, but it's like, if I call him, I know one of the things he's going to ask me is how my 6 going to go, you know? So, I got Cody's book a couple of weeks ago, also works with Dave. So, you know, I kind of cheat a little bit. I make Cody one of my 6. Cody's got open liberty to make me, you know, one of his 6, you know. And, so when I shared, I call 6 people a day, this guy from, you know, from out by Toronto shoots me a private message. He wants to talk, you know. And like I said, you know, God puts you on the firing lines when you're ready to show up, you know. So I got a sponsee out of this Zoom, you know. So, you know, I show up on the firing lines and God, like I said, God, I get back involved in my home group. I get back involved with my sponsor. I get back into spiritual exercises. God throws me out on the firing lines. You know, I picked up him. He throws my name and number to a friend of his, another friend of his, you know, wants me to take him through the work. So I went from 0 to 2 in less than a week and a half, you know. So, you know, God certainly does have a sense of humor, and he knows how to, you know, make us, you know. You know, another exercise that Dave had me do, and I just finished it today, is, you know, he has, you know, in the book, it says the wording, of course, is quite optional when it talks about the third step. So I wrote my own third step prayer, you know, again today, so I can pump up my prayer and meditation life, you know. So, I'm going to start, I actually work with that before the meeting, because I was like, all right, God, I wrote the prayer. Let's see how effective it is, you know. And I got down on my knees, and my wife was tucking in our daughter. My son was upstairs on his iPad. So, you know, I'm still too cool to be caught praying. So I made sure that everybody was busy before I got down on my knees. You know, I got down on my knees, you know, and said my version of the third step prayer. And I know the God of my understanding who loves me today, you know, heard me, and he gave me the strength, because, you know, I was able to pull this off, you know, you know, because like I said in the beginning, I'm a guy who likes to be part of the crowd. I just want to blend in. You know, but God, you know, if you ask God to use you, and you are spiritually fit, you know, watch, you know, just watch where he sends you and watch what he does with you. Because the life I have today, you know, one of the other things that Joe told me a long time ago, he told me, he says, you know, he says, everybody who says that AA is going to give you a life beyond your wildest dreams. And I was like, yeah, I've heard that. And he goes, Matt, give up on your wildest dreams. He goes, because if you come up with wild dreams, he says, then you're going to cut off God's handiwork. You know, God could give you, he goes, exactly what, you know, the life that you want, he wants you to have. And like I said, I never pictured that I could be the type of person that, you know, when you say, you know, till death do us part, then they agree to it. I never thought I could be the type of person who could have, you know, kids who could take care of them. You know, I don't do it perfectly, you know, like Derek said last week, and I loved it, so I'm going to have to steal it. You know, it's like my kids have seen me on page 52. You know, my wife has seen me on page 52. You know, my employer's seen me on page 52. You know, my home group has seen me on page 52. So I don't, you know, I don't walk on water just because I do this work. You know, but I do this, you know, the places I fall short today, you know, set me up for the places that I can work on tomorrow. You know, one of the things that Derek shared with me, you know, a long time ago, which I just started doing, you know, semi-religiously, I don't do it every night. I'm not going to lie and say I do, but, you know, he has a format where you can do your 11-step nightly review. And when you're done, you could hit submit and it goes to his email inbox. And he, in turn, when he does one, you know, it goes to his guys, you know, inboxes. So when I wake up in the morning, you know, I get to read Derek's nightly review, and, you know, and I know what mine was, you know, where I fell short. So I know what I get to work on. You know, so, you know, if you plug into the fellowship that you crave and you stay close to that God of your understanding, you know, like I said, I came in here hopeless and helpless, or so I thought. You know, all I did was take a course of action, and out of that course of action, you know, produced a miracle. You know, I was told don't leave till the miracle happens, but it's not my job, okay, to, you know, to make the miracle happen. God's got the outcome, but it is my job to take care of the footwork. You know, so, you know, whew, I just looked at the clock, and, you know, Derek says I'm a big fan of talk, and I guess he's right. I was able to kill the whole hour. So, you know, thanks guys for having a Zoom format, you know, where, you know, I can carry a message that, you know, God can take, you know, can take somebody and carry them to a place, you know, of miracles happening. And, I end a lot of talks, you know, with this, you know, just because, you know, it means a lot to me. So I'll share it with you guys. You know, like I said, I grew up with an alcoholic, you know, my dad was active. You know, I am an alcoholic, so my son is growing up with an alcoholic, but it's an alcoholic in recovery. You know, in my big book, I carry this coaster on one side, and I'll hold it up so you guys can see the camera. On one side is ice cream. On the other side is beer. So I was out at a restaurant with my son, and he slides the coaster across the table to me, and he goes, Dad, he goes, do you like ice cream? He goes, or do you like beer? You know, so I said to him, he was five, you know, he's like 5 years old at the time. I said, well, buddy, I says, we're out eating ice cream together, you know, because I always make time for my son. I always make sure that, you know, I take him out, you know, what we call dude's time, where just him and I hang out, you know, because I never got that with my dad. And the so I said, well, buddy, we're having dude's time right now. We're eating some ice cream. So, you know, Dad likes ice cream. And I turned it over and I showed him the beer. And I says, Daddy doesn't drink. And I says, so I says, I don't like beer. And my five-year-old son looked at me, and, you know, with all the love in his eyes and all the love in his voice, he goes, Dad, he goes, you drink a lot. He goes, you drink lots of coffee. If you asked me at 5 years old what my dad's drink of choice was, my answer would not have been coffee. You know, so I always get choked up, you know, because, you know, it's like my son looks at me today as a man who drinks too much coffee, not a man who drinks too much alcohol. You know, I spend time with my son so that, you know, even when I snap and he sees me on page 52, because I don't do it perfectly, you know, I do, when I tuck him in every night, I do, you know, I do make sure, he says, you know, Dad loves you, right? And every night he says, yes, I do. And I give my son a kiss on the head and a hug, you know, and a hug. You know, now that my daughter's getting old enough, you know, she gives me a kiss, and, you know, she has to give me a big hug, you know. So when I get a big hug from my daughter, we both have to go, "Rrr!" Okay, because that's a big hug. Without it, it's not just a regular hug, and we need a big hug, you know. So I'm raising my kids not in perfection, you know, but spiritual progress, you know, every day, you know, and that they know that, you know, they're growing up in a household where there is alcoholism, but there's treated alcoholism. You know, so they're grown up of one where there's love and tolerance, you know. And like I said, so this coaster has a permanent spot in my big book to remind me, you know, that my son never has to see me take a drink, and that my son can see, you know. Actually, here's another funny one. I'll actually end with this. Is my son is, this is 2014, so he's not even 3 years old yet. There's a picture of my son sitting in front of the 12 steps and 12 traditions at my home group. And if you look in front of him, there's a big book. So should my son ever needs it, he's had plenty of, you know, plenty of exposure to it. And, you know, a buddy of mine always says, I never liked my drinks watered down, and I don't want my AA watered down. And that's the message of depth and weight, you know, that I carry, that, you know, a non-watered down message from our original 100 men and women. So that should either one of my kids need AA, you know, that it's going to be around for them. And, thanks again for letting me share.